You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Lauren, I don't know about you, but after all of the work that we put in covering the show, I'm ready to go into hibernation until season two happens at this point. I need a good long rest.
I can understand that. And I hope that Renera, after her horrible, no good, very bad day, she got at least some sleep. Because I was like, this is a lot for one lady to deal with in a day. This is very much like, this is way too much for one lady. So...
yeah, we'll definitely get into that a little bit, because I, too, had some timeline questions about how this was all transpiring.
Yes, I agree as well.
Yeah, lots to unpack.
Yes, but you have been talking to our various House of the Dragon creators, and you will be publishing a ton of content, and you already have published a ton of content to EW over the next couple days, so everyone should watch out for that. You've already published a few postmortems.
Yeah, it's turning into kind of a week-long coverage affair of the finale, which I didn't intend. It's just kind of happening that way. I interviewed showrunner Ryan Condal, and we published two articles from that interview. One about a certain big moment that happens in this finale episode, and another about what he can say about season two. He's currently fleshing out the drafts of scripts for season two at the moment. He didn't want to say too much, but I think what he said, you know, we could kind of glean from where the season one finale episode leaves us off. And then I also interviewed director Greg Yatanis, who directed this season finale episode. That interview will be coming this week. And I have a couple more surprises that I'm not going to reveal just yet.
Exciting.
But they will also be coming towards the end of the week. And then Friday, I'm just going to collapse into a heap.
well-deserved rest. So that's good.
Yeah.
But I think we could probably start breaking down this series finale or season finale. Excuse me, not series finale. So
yeah,
shall we get to it?
Yeah, let's get to it. I mean, for anyone listening in, hi, I'm Nick, a senior writer here at EW. And Lauren Morgan, our fearless photo editor and podcast queen at EW. We co-host West of Westeros, Entertainment Weekly's Game of Thrones podcast. We're doing things a little bit differently this week because HBO did not send press screeners of the finale episode in advance like they normally have been. So we haven't been able to record our podcast in the typical release window. So we're taking to Twitter space to kind of break down all of the juiciness, all the events that happens. And Lauren, I mean, we've been talking about this show all season long. I'm so happy that you're here to talk about this episode specifically.
I know. It's been so much fun, like, breaking down the first season of House of the Dragon with you. And you've done an excellent job covering it. I just wanted to give you a shout out. And if you guys have not read Nick's great coverage, please go to EW. There's tons of stuff to sate your curiosity about this show. So what did you think, though, of the season finale?
Yeah, I mean, so really quickly, just for anyone listening, just because, you know, this is a Twitter space, our kind of standard podcast rules apply. So we're still going to be talking about the show with the understanding that anything that's aired on the series up to this point is fair game to talk about, as is anything that's been mentioned in the press so far. We'll only be bringing in the books if we feel that it helps clarify what we're seeing on screen. But then we're going to have a smaller section later on in this discussion where we really bring in the books, talk about the show in relation to George R. R. Martin's Fire and Blood, and really kind of have a spoiler-friendly open conversation, as it were. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, listen, I know a lot of people have already shared their opinions on social media about this episode. I really appreciated it. I really did. I liked how it was paired with the penultimate, which was very much focused on Allison and the Greens. And this episode mm-hmm. is very much focused on Rhaenyra and the Blacks, and sort of seeing how both sides are really responding to the death of the king. Rhaenyra, to me, felt far more complex of a character than when we get in the book. I will say, and this is a very minor book spoiler, it's actually not really a spoiler, it's just a line of dialogue we get in the mm-hmm. books, where Rhaenyra has this line where, you know, she says, tell my half-brother, I will have my throne or I will have his head. But we don't get that mm-hmm. in the show. And I understand why.
She seemed like she's thinking it right at the end, though. Like, that look on her face looks like she's about to take someone's head off.
But yeah, I mean, in the book, she very much comes across as like, how dare the Greens do this to me? Like, I'm out for blood. We're, mm-hmm. we're ready to rally the troops. But you really spend a lot of time with her internal conflict in this episode. And really seeing everything that she's grappling with, and understanding that, you know, she's the king is dead. She has a miscarriage, which we'll talk about a little bit more earlier in this discussion. Mm-hmm. And then everything that happens in the end. I mean, it's kind of a journey for me. I don't know. Lauren, what did you feel about this?
I thought it was, you know, I thought it was really great to see just how much conflict that Rhaenyra was feeling. And I did like the fact that we just solely focused on her. It wasn't like we were going back and forth to King's Landing. Like, this was really just everything from Rhaenyra's perspective, everything that was just happening on Dragonstone. I really liked that. Emma Darcy was magnificent, I thought, just trying to juggle all of the conflict that, like, that, you know, Rhaenyra couldn't believe, almost like didn't want to believe that Allison had done this, and then trying to come to grips with that, trying to come to grips with the fact that she was now queen, and that now she really did have to take the responsibility of the realm. Like, you know, she had to think about, like, what, like, she did not want to just start, you know, sending the dragons flying and start torching stuff, which, you know, Daemon did. She really was trying to think this through and think, like, what could be done that would not cause a war. And I thought that just sort of, like, sense of conflict. And as I said before, like, she's having a no good, very terrible, very bad day. Because it's like, you know, she finds out her father dies. She starts to have, you know, she starts to have a miscarriage and another horrible, horrible birthing scene. I don't need to see any more birthing scenes from the show. This was just like, you know, because it seems like I know in the book that her daughter, she did have a daughter, it was called Visenya, came a full moon early. So I assume, like, just like a month or so early. But, you know, back in those times, you didn't have NICUs and all this kind of stuff. And it just does seem like the daughter was stillborn anyway. So it just was sort of like, oh, that was awful. And then right as she's trying to bury it, like, you know, Sir Eric shows up with the crown, and, you know, it's just like, this lady, she, like, just needs to, like, take a nap and have a drink. Like, this is a lot for her to process. I did feel terrible for her in that, you know, but I just thought that the Emma's performance was great, though.
Yeah, I think my favorite scene of Emma's is after Rhaenyra is crowned queen. She walks into the war room at Dragonstone with a crown on her head, and you can feel the awkwardness. She's getting yeah. used to this position she now has. The guards walk in line with her in step.
Yeah,
she gives them a hand, like, no, stand back, I'm good. And then Rhaena comes over, gives her a cup of wine. I was talking to my roommate about this, and she said that what stood out to her was that, you know, these are all things that would have been happening for King Viserys.
Yeah.
And now these same thing. I mean, Viserys loves a glass of wine. And now these same things are, they assume these same things should be applied to Rhaenyra. And she's having a hard time with that, kind of adjusting to this new normal. What was one of your favorite scenes of Emma Darcy's performance?
Oh, just that the entire, I will say, like, the birth scene is as awful as it was. Like, she was just, you know, she was so good in it. And we're, and just the fact that she wouldn't let herself be touched. It's like she's just reliving the horror of her mother's birth, her mother's death. And so, like, that whole scene where she's just, like, trying to manage this, but going through, like, you know, I just thought she was really great at that. But, like, yeah, that scene where she just comes in and she's just, like, she doesn't know quite how to be queen yet. And she's just looking around and she realizes everyone's looking at her and how she's just trying to kind of work her way through it. And, like, trying to figure out. And then she has just Damon, who is, I thought that was the interesting thing about Damon, where I was just sort of like, Damon up until this point seemed like he was, like, very supportive of her, very like, what do you want me to do? You want me to cut his head off? All right, I'll cut his head off. Like, you know, like, just kind of like her right hand, and like sort of like this fissure that you see between them, where Damon's like, war now. And Rhaenyra, you know, also has to, you know, she's birthing their child, so she can't kind of control him. Like, that kind of, that aspect of it, I was a little bit like, you know, I didn't really quite feel that on Damon's side. But in terms of, like, there were, she just had so many great scenes that I was like, oh, this will definitely be their Emmy reel.
Yeah. So just to clarify, when we're talking about Rhaenyra, we'll use she, her pronouns. When we're talking about Emma Darcy, the actor, we'll use they, them. But let's talk about this birthing scene a little bit more. I don't Ryan Condal has, you know, described this season in particular in part as an exploration of the trauma of childbirth. But these birthing sequences so hard to watch.
Yeah.
This one in particular, because we see Rhaenyra reach inside of herself and pull her stillborn daughter out of her womb. And then shot of this, like, poor dead Visenya on the floor covered in blood. It's a lot. And I'm trying to understand if there are, like, what the merits are for actually showing that kind of very graphic depiction of it. Lauren, do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, it did show, like, what a terrible thing she's going through, but I was just like, and having, you know, I have given birth to a child myself, I did not need it. It was very, very graphic. And I did feel bad for, you know, anyone who potentially had dealt with pregnancy loss. This could be extremely triggering. So if you haven't watched the episode yet, just know that. There were certain shots where I was like, I don't know if we needed to see that shot. I think we could have kind of gotten what was going on here without it being so visceral. But I mean, yeah, that was like, I was like, this is a little bit much for me. But I was really moved when she was wrapping the baby herself and wasn't letting the Silent Sisters do it, that she was, like, preparing the baby, you know, for its funeral pyre. And I just was like, oh God, you know, I am curious though, at exactly what the timeline was, because this kind of made it seem like this was all the same day. But perhaps it was not, because I was like, yeah, this is a very busy day you've got going here. You know, where she, you know, Sarah Eric shows up with the crown at the funeral, and her coronation is also the baby's funeral. And you're like, this is a lot. So I don't know how you felt about that.
Yeah, it was a little hard to kind of piece together. One thing before we kind of talk about, you know, timeline questions that I wanted to bring up is one thing that I did like about the childbirth scene is there's a moment where the camera flashes between the face of Rhaenyra and the face of, I believe it's Syrax, but it could be another dragon. Mm-hmm. And that brought me back to, like, a passage in Fire and Blood where one of the historical accounts of these events states that when Visenya was stillborn, she came out looking almost like a half-human, half-dragon hybrid. And so that was where my mind, like, initially went. I spoke to Greg Utanis, and we're going to be releasing that interview in full a bit later on the podcast and also on EW.com. But he said that he really wanted to kind of emphasize this kind of mystical connection between Targaryens and their dragon, and, like, what Rhaenyra is going through in this moment is also what Syrax is kind of empathetically feeling at this time. Greg also mentioned that Emma Darcy was very hands-on and very influential in crafting this birthing scene in particular, which I thought was really interesting. And we'll be revealing more from that conversation a little bit earlier again. But yeah, timeline questions. I get the sense maybe, the birthing situation that was, I don't know, it felt like all like the same day to me. Like it started in the morning, coronation was later in the day, and then maybe, I don't know, the next day. I don't know. I'm still piecing it all together in my head. Yeah. I mean, we just both saw this episode last night. We're still wrapping our heads around it. What were some of your other big timeline questions when it came to this episode, Lauren?
I guess I was like how long did it take Rhaenys? Like, I'm assuming it does not take long to go between King's Landing and Dragonstone. So I'm assuming Rhaenys landed on the same day as the coronation. So she just busted through the dragon pit and headed to Rhaenyra. So I'm assuming it's like that morning. What I did like, though, was how everything with Luke, and Luke was afraid that Rhaenys was coming to announce that he was becoming Lord of Driftmark.
And I know.
His relief, where he's like, oh, thank God. Like, that's not, you know, that's not here. And that was a kind of interesting. And then also with Corlys, and I was so glad to see Steve Toussaint, and I think he's been marvelous as Corlys. And I was so glad to see him back in this, because I think he gives a real energy to the scenes where it's sort of like, and when he showed up to, I guess, the Black Council, I think that was what that was, like, when he sort of showed up and was like, you know, you have our support. And it was very interesting because, like, in the book, there wasn't all of that sort of doubt about what Corlys and Rhaenys would do. Like, they were just on Team Black, and you kind of just knew it. But, like, I liked the fact that the show kind of had their back and forth about, like, knowing that, you know, the Velaryons were, like, the Velaryon boys were not their son Laenor's, but, like, the fact that, like, you know, Rhaenyra, basically all of their grandchildren are tied up with Rhaenyra. And so it's sort of like, you know, to support their own house, they support Rhaenyra. But I did really think that was, like, I was so glad to see him back. And because, like, once you know that Lord Corlys is on Rhaenyra's side, you're like, oh, they've got a fighting chance now because this new sea snake is there. So, but yeah, I did have some questions about, like, you know, because they were announcing that he was coming from Driftmark, and then, but then you never really saw him, and then he wound up in, like, you know, there were some sort of, like, there were some timeline issues here where I would have liked to know exactly how many days this was occurring over.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Rhaenys. I want to bring up a couple of things. Yeah, I felt she was so much fun to watch in this episode.
Yeah.
The first thing I want to bring up is when she first gets to Dragonstone and is telling Daemon and Rhaenyra about everything that happened at King's Landing. Daemon is visibly and audibly pissed off that she didn't just torch the whole place and kill all the greens as retribution. Mm-hmm. And it's in listening to all the inside the episode featurettes and also talking to the various behind the scenes creators about that moment. It seems like everybody had a different answer for why Rhaenys didn't torch everybody. Mm-hmm. But then Rhaenys gives an answer in this episode saying a war is probably going to be raged over the throne. I'm not going to be the one to start war. And that made a lot more sense to me.
Yeah, I thought that was really, like, when she said that, because, I mean, I saw, like, last week on Twitter, everyone was like, she should have yelled to Kara. She should, you know, there was, like, kind of a lot of controversy about it. But her saying, you know, and as we, I think we talked about last week, that she was basically firing a warning shot. And she's right here. This is not her war to start. This is, like, it's Rhaenyra's throne. And, it, you know, she's, yeah, when she said that, I was just like, yeah, that totally explains her thinking here. That, you know, there's going to be a war, but she's not going to be the one to start this whole thing. So I thought that was, you know, that was, I think, a good, I thought she was great in the whole episode, as I've thought the rest of the season.
Yeah, it was a little strange to me, though. I'm like, why aren't any of the creatives kind of saying that Like, yeah. That's in the show.
And I wonder if they were just going to, they were letting Renee sort of speak for herself after, you know, after this whole thing. Like, you know, it's like, oh, she'll answer it. And because, you know, it's because Damon asks immediately. And I'm like, I'm glad Damon asked, because if they hadn't have asked, it would have been a very much like, is no one asking why she didn't just light this whole thing up? So I was like, oh, so there's an in-show reason why that didn't happen. So,
yeah. Yeah. It's also playing into Rhaenys's kind of respect for Rhaenyra in this moment. Just as Rhaenys showed restraint and not killing all the Greens at the coronation, she's admiring the fact that Rhaenyra now as queen is the only one at the war table, at the painted table, so to speak, showing restraint. I also loved all these very just small kind of throwaway moments with Rhaenys. When Rhaenyra is crowned initially, Rhaenys is the only person who's like not sort of security, basically kneeling. She's just standing up. And then when Rhaenyra enters the war room at Dragonstone for the first time with her crown, Rhaenys is the only one in the room not bowing her head. And then also, I think my favorite, though, it has to be when, you know, Damon is kind of comparing dick sizes a little bit and like saying, who has the most dragons? Which side has the most dragons? He mentions, oh, we have Meleese. And Rhaenys just gives a little head tilt.
Yeah, that was like, such a subtle moment.
Oh, I was just like, really, bitch? You think you have my dragon? Nice. Yeah. Nice try. It's nice try with that.
I haven't decided where my dragon is going yet. So, you know. I did think, like, Yves did a lot of, like, great silent acting. And especially in that scene where Rhaenyra's crowned and she does not bow. But later on, when she does decide, Corlys mentions that they have the stepstone, and then she steps up and she's like, I will take Meleese to guard the gullet. And then you're just like, oh, so, you know, basically Rhaenys is like, I shall decide when I join this war.
So let's now talk about Damon. I feel like so many people have been getting behind Damon, just like viewers, and wanting to root for him. And then he, in this episode in particular, he really reminds us that, wait, he is the guy who like just straight up murdered his past wife, like bashed her over the head with a rock until she was dead. And we get that moment where he's choking Rhaenyra in the throne room, and also like hearing Rhaenyra's cries for him during the childbirthing sequence, and he just pays it no mind. He goes off like planning this war that he really wants. Lauren, what were sort of your impressions of this whole Damon, and also the likability of Damon? Should we like him?
Well, I mean, I found like Damon, I think, is one of the characters that really popped over the season. And I think that's just, you know, partially to like Matt Smith, such a great actor. And he always just comes at things in sort of an untraditional manner. Like he always just spins a line in a way that you wouldn't expect him to. And so I understand like the viewers, you know, why he's become sort of a fan favorite. But this was a reminder, like, oh yeah, Damon's not a nice person. And, you know, coming up, Damon is going to do some stuff that is pretty dark, not to get into spoilers too much. But like when he started choking Rhaenyra, I was like, oh, I did not. That sort of threw me off a little bit, because it was like, but you do start to see that there's sort of a fissure between them. Of like him, you know, he's always wanted the throne himself. And, I do think he truly does care for Rhaenyra. This was a very sort of dark moment. And I thought that was very interesting when Rhaenyra's like, oh, Viserys never told you about the prophecy.
Yeah, that was a big question. One of the lingering questions, like, did Damon, as the former heir to Viserys, did he know was he told about Aegon's prophecy? And we get an answer that no, he really didn't.
Or maybe Viserys told them, but they were both drunk and Damon forgot.
I did ask Ryan Condal about the Damon situation, because I know some of the fan feedback was that, you know, this was kind of going against his own character or motivations to choke Rhaenyra. I'll just read one quote that he gave. And he references a passage in Fire and Blood that there was not a man so admired, so beloved, and so reviled in all Westeros. And he goes on to say, quote, "He's not the cowboy in the white hat. He's a deeply wounded, complex, dark individual that is capable of doing some really great things. But Daemon is a prickly pear. He is a complex individual who has some real darkness and violence in him." And I think that tracked.
Yeah,
certainly.
Pretty much. Yeah.
In this episode. But I don't know. What do you think, Lauren? Do you feel like, especially that moment of him choking Rhaenyra, did you feel like it was going against what we knew of this established character in season one?
Yeah, it was like, I could almost buy everything else. Like, Daemon, like, get my dragon, we're going to war. Like, that stuff with the choking was just one thing where I was like, but, you know, he did murder his other wife. So maybe that just sort of took me aback in one way. But, you know, Daemon is not nothing but unpredictable. So... I could kind of see it. It was just very interesting, though, like how this sort of like confluence of the events was in a healthy relationship to people would lean on each other. But, you know, there was him dealing with their stillborn child's birth and like the whole and him thinking that Alicent murdered Viserys, where I was like, dude, look at what your brother was like. There wasn't, you know, that didn't take much, probably, you know, but how he immediately just went to thinking that they had killed his brother, you know, so he is a little bit of a paranoid sort, but that part was like very interesting how he just kind of immediately thought that.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The one thing though I did notice is that obviously that like that final scene when he's walking and it's just all their backs and he just walks up to Rhaenyra and you can tell what he told her that Luke had died and just like how like in just even just the way that like Emma just stumbled and you know that he had to be the one to break it to her that Luke was dead and that you know she'd lost two children within the course of I don't know, a day, 2 days, you know, that this would put stress on any kind of marriage. So it's kind of an interesting part of it.
And that brings up another timeline question. Like,
one,
how did Daemon find out about the death of Luke? Because we're led to believe that no body was found.
Yeah.
At least that's what we know in the book. And clearly Luke and Arax, his dragon, fell into the ocean. And who told him?
Yeah. Like, I don't
who
know.
Sent a raven?
I don't. Yeah. It seemed like it happened pretty far up and probably a little bit away from Storm's End. But I don't know if Aemon arrived back on Storm's End after his little oopsie, which we'll talk about. But yeah, I'm curious who sent the raven or, you know, I do think like, perhaps maybe they should have sent somebody else to Storm's End. Like maybe Rhaenyse should have gone to Storm's End because like she is part Baratheon. So she might have been a better emissary here, but alas, poor Luke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One other thing before we talk about Storm's End that I want to bring up is that it wasn't clear in the episode, like no one named this creature that we see.
Mm-hmm.
But HBO confirmed on Twitter that the dragon, this massive dragon that Daemon visits singing his High Valyrian lullaby going into the caverns in the caves at the Dragon Mount and Dragonstone, that is Vermithor, which is the dragon that once bonded with King Jaehaerys Targaryen. And the dragon has not been mounted by another rider since Jaehaerys's death. Which I thought was really, and I mean, I feel like a lot of people predicted it was Vermithor.
Yeah, that's what I thought, but I was just like, I mean, I knew it could be that or a Silverwing, but like one of the, it had to be one of the older dragons, but I assumed that it was Vermithor.
Yeah, and it really lines up very nicely with this scene that we get, this face-off between Daemon and Rhaenyra and Otto on the bridge of Dragonstone, because Otto is telling them, you know, every symbol of legitimacy belongs to Aegon. He's talking about, you know, Aegon has the Conqueror's crown, he has the Conqueror's name, the Blackfyre sword, he also has Viserys's dagger. So it makes a lot of sense for Daemon to want, like, this symbol of the Old King's dragon on their side. And not just the Old King, but, like, he was one of the most peaceful Targaryen rulers. Yeah.
He's considered the best one out of everyone, you know.
Yeah. And then also, on top of that, there's the fact that, you know, aside from Vhagar, Vermithor is the biggest dragon in Westeros at this time, I believe. But did you have, like, any other theories about what dragon that could have been?
I was wondering, because I know, and this is something that comes up in the book, that there are a bunch of dragons on Dragonstones that don't have riders. And some of them are dragons that had once had riders, like Vermithor and Silverwing, which Silverwing was the the Queen Alysanne's, that was her mount. And when she died, you know, no one had taken over her as her rider. But then there's other dragons on Dragonstone that have never had riders yet. And so they just have a lot of dragons on Dragonstones, but not that can be ridden in battle. And so I thought this is just sort of like a hint of, like, you know, that this is they need riders for these dragons for the dance to come. So I thought that was, like, a little bit, you know, I was kind of fascinated by Daemon going and doing this. Though I did think at a certain point, I was like, man, maybe you should be comforting your wife right now before you're going to find Vermithor. But, you know, Vermithor hasn't moved in a while. He's going to be there. So,
yeah,
that was my thought. But I was just glad we got to see lots of dragons, and I like the dragons. So I was like, more dragons. So,
and speaking of dragons, yes, let's now talk about Storm's End, because in the Civil War that is known as the Dance of the Dragons, this is the very first dragon fight since the days of old Valyria, if I'm getting my history right. And just to table set this a little bit, this is, you know, this results in the death of Luke and his dragon Arax. To recap a little bit, Luke and Jace are sent as two of Rhaenyra's envoys to ensure support among her allies and remind the lords of Westeros that they swore her fealty as the future queen. Luke goes to Storm's End, home to House Baratheon, but he finds that Aemond Targaryen is already there doing the exact same thing for the Greens. And also Aemond has sweetened the deal. He's brought marriage proposals for Boris Baratheon's daughters. So Boris shoots down Luke's offer, or the queen's offer, I should say. And then Aemond is looking for a fight. He's still butthurt about the fact that he lost an eye. I mean, kind of understandably.
Yes.
And he's,
though well deserved on his part. He was talking smack, and that's what he'd get for talking smack.
Totally. So he's looking for some retribution. He tries to get Luke to take out his own eye as payment. Things don't go well, but Boris is like, not under my roof. I don't. Yeah. Luke came as an envoy, a messenger. I will not have bloodshed. You know, leave. Take Luke to his dragon. And so things play out a little bit differently in the book. I think we can talk about this scene in particular as it relates to the book, because there are a lot of, I think, key differences. The biggest one being that Aemond didn't really mean to kill Luke. He just lost control of his dragon. I mean, both boys lost control of their dragons. It was Arax who breathed fire at Vhagar, that then pissed off Vhagar enough to go and want to kill Arax, Luke along with him. I know some people really didn't like this scene, especially those who really love Fire and Blood and George R. R. Martin's work. Lauren, what did you think about this?
It's like one of those things, and I had just wrote Best and Worst Changes for EW, and I've been all day long trying to figure out if I liked this change or not, because it is one thing when you realize that Aemond, although he looks so much older than the actor who's playing Luke, is not that old at this point. He's like, I think on the show he's like supposed to be 16. He was like 19 in the book. He's a fierce warrior and everything, but he's still just a stupid teenage boy. So part of it is like, You know, I mean, I did think the whole battle, like the whole chase, like was really well done. And I know House of the Dragon has been having some issues with criticisms that things were too dark. But I was watching it last night. It was nice. I was watching it on a very big television. And I was like, I thought the whole thing was really well filmed, like how, you know, they were filming Irax from the bottom. And then you just saw the shadow of how much bigger Vhagar was. So I thought the whole entire chase scene was really, really, really well done. But that sort of oops moment, I was just like, Aemon, what were you planning to do? Like, you were chasing him, like you were trying to kill him. Like, did you just want to force him down and take out his eye? And you were like, oops, I killed him. Like, it's like, you know, Luke's not a big person. Taking the eye out might have, killed him as well. So that little bit like, oh no. So I'm still trying to like, maybe I will come to a decision on it later on in the week. But, it does make Aemon's, like, he's a little one note in the books where you're just like, he's just like, you know, fierce and bad. And this does add a little bit of complexity to him where he's just like, oh, you can also just be, you might be a fierce fighter and you're wearing a sapphire in your eye, but you're also a little bit of just a knucklehead teenage boy. So I'm kind of back and forth on it. What did you think about this?
It didn't really bother me, the change, too much. I kept thinking back to a couple of lines of dialogue that we heard in previous episodes. I believe it was, Rhaenyra, that scene between her and Daemon at the end of episode 7, where she says, fire is such a strange power. Everything that House Targaryen possesses is owed to it, yet it has cost us both what we love. Mm-hmm. And then there's a line that King Viserys tells young Rhaenyra in episode 1. I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but it's along the lines of, we think we control dragons, but, there's no controlling dragons. And so I felt this change really spoke to this idea that Targaryens, especially these two kids, I think Luke is 14 at this point. Aemon isn't that much older at the time. And they assume that they are in control of these two gargantuan beasts. I mean, Vhagar is obviously much more giant than little Arax. Oh, that was so devastating. But, it kind of speaks to this, the hubris, kind of the ego that all these Targaryens have. I mean, they've been told since birth that they're by the small folk that they're closer to gods than men. And I think in this scene, it kind of really brought all of these different kind of threads to light. It's like, oh shit, the dragons are also characters. They also have
personalities.
On a smaller note, I really liked the moment in the chase sequence where Luke rises above the clouds on the back of Arax. He gets all the way up. The rain, it's no longer raining.
Oh yeah, he's above the rain, yeah.
You see the sunlight. There's that kind of like moment of hope that maybe he's escaped it before Vhagar comes up and delivers the kill blow. But it reminded me of something Corlys said earlier in the episode. He arrives at Dragonstone after, and pledges his house and fleet to Rhaenyra. And he says something that's like, hope is the fool's ally.
Yeah.
And this was very much sort of the visual representation of that. And also in another sense, if we're getting, more metaphorical and all this, Luke was Rhaenyra's son who didn't want to be heir to Driftmark. He was really doubting himself. He was really doubting his capabilities, just as Rhaenyra doubted herself when she was his age. Jace is very much like, I'm the heir to the Iron Throne. I'm doing all this to prepare myself for it. But not little old Luke. And so I feel like with the death of Luke comes the death of Rhaenyra's own doubts and insecurities, and now she just wants to kill everybody.
Yeah. She really just truly does become the Black Queen at that moment. Because, I think it's very interesting with between Allison's parenting and Rhaenyra's parenting, that Rhaenyra seems to take much more of a joy out of being a mother and trying to raise good children than Allison does. Like, Allison seems to hate her children, hate being a mother. But here you really see that, Rhaenyra's like taken this responsibility like really seriously to try and make sure that Jace understands, like when Jace comes while she's in the middle of labor and being like, Jace, you are now the heir to all of trying to imbue him with the responsibility of what it means to be the heir to the Iron Throne, that like you can't just go off and decide to destroy things, like this is your responsibility. And she's trying, you know, and she sort of understands that like Luke is not ready yet. But Luke wants to be brave. He wants to support his mother. So she's like, just to go to Storm's End. It's not that far. It's like when, like the first time you're like, you have a kid and they want to cross the street by themselves. You're like, let's try this dead end street here. Like, you know, it's like, go right there. We're not going to put you on a highway. We're just going to, you know, we're going to do like, so she's trying to give him like a small task that he can do, and just, unfortunately, he ran into the biggest dragon in Westeros, and you're just like, oh, this poor young sweet boy. Like, yeah. It's just awful. Yeah.
So a little teaser for my interview with director Greg Yutanis, who also directed episodes 2 and 3, all the Stepstones episodes for House of the Dragon season 1. Little teaser, which I loved. He mentioned that prior to directing this episode, he watched How to Train Your Dragon, and he watched the original Jurassic Park, which
I could see that. Yeah,
he has that great shot of, you know, the rain and the lightning being our only light source, and Luke looks up and sees Vhagar in the background rearing its head like the T-Rex in Jurassic Park. Which I absolutely loved.
Yeah.
And then Ryan Condal also mentioned Spielberg's 1971 movie Duel.
Oh, yeah, I could see that. Yeah.
And that is, and Greg kind of clarified, he said that was mainly a reference to the fact that, you know, Aemond doesn't really come in the action until very much later on, and then is a very integral part of that. But now let's take this time. I'm going to say, like, let's bring in the book and talk, have more of a kind of spoilery, kind of open conversation. In case, I feel like everybody has so many thoughts, especially book readers, about this episode. Lauren, was there anything either that you liked or didn't like, that maybe House of the Dragon is now clarifying, from the events of Fire and Blood, changing completely to kind of, you know, for better or worse, serve its story? Anything that's kind of lingering that is sticking out in your mind?
The main thing is that in the book, Alicent and Aemond were very much all of the Greens were very much like, we are stealing this throne. And, you know, like there seemed to be no doubt with them. They were doing it. They were ambitious. They were schemers. They were, you know, they didn't care who was the heir. And this one, like House of the Dragon, has interjected a lot of like self-doubt. Like Alicent all last week in the penultimate episode, like she thinks she's doing what Viserys has asked for. You know, it conveniently lines up with what she's always wanted, but she really honestly thinks that this was Viserys's final wish. And she's really trying to like prevent, like she does feel something for Rhaenyra. She doesn't want her to die. She knows that Viserys wouldn't want this. And then I think also, like, you know, even though I'm somewhat conflicted on Aemond and his big oops, that does really interject a more human element to him that I don't think was in the books, where he's just like, oh, you know, he's not this just sort of evil, you know, jerk killing his nephew, but that this was just like, you know, he was being a jerk, but it just kind of got out of his control. So I think that's kind of interesting that they've created a lot more sort of on the side of the Greens. I mean, Otto is still basically just as the Otto was in the book. There's no doubt there. He's just like, I'm taking this thing for my family. But I have found it fascinating how much they've sort of interjected this question of doubt on the side of the Greens. How about you?
Yeah, I think one thing that really kind of sticks out to me is just seeing who gets what piece of dialogue in House of the Dragon versus Fire and Blood. you know, in the book, the sea snake is very much part of these earlier conversations around the painted table. And he's saying things along the lines of, you know, we don't want to rule the city. We want to rule the city, not burn it to the ground, that kind of thing. But I found it interesting in House of the Dragon that, you know, a similar line was given to Rhaenyra. And so, you know, if we're taking the approach that House of the Dragon is, you know, the objective account of the events of the Dance of the Dragons, even, you know, an adaptation compare of the book and not a strict one-to-one, you know, I found it interesting that, you know, if we're thinking about the idea that history is written by the victors, how, you know, whoever is writing the history books, like years and years and years down the line, is addressing these events, and and it's really Rhaenyra who's the one showing restraint. Meanwhile, all the men out around her who are getting credit in the historical record for holding restraint are the ones urging her to war. I thought that was, I like that kind of vision. That worked for me. This brings me to the Easter egg section, or any, not just Easter eggs, but any kind of like fun moment or line or sigil spotting, anything like that, that stood out to you?
There was the one thing was that, you know, in the show, we've got the Eric and the Eric twins. And it's Eric in the show that shows up with her crown. But in the book, it was Stefan Darklyn who came with her crown. And Eric was on her side, but he wasn't the one who stole the crown from King's Landing. So that was kind of one that sort of like popped in. I don't know particularly if that's an Easter egg, but like I always remembered, like, you know, it was one of the knights of the now the Queen's Guard who came to deliver her father's crown to her. I'm trying to think of like what other Easter egg is. Do you have any that popped out for you?
One that I really liked is this line that Daemon has. He says, "It is no easy thing for a man to be a dragon slayer, but dragons can kill dragons and have." And that is a direct line from Fire and Blood. And I was so, so happy to see that in the show, especially because we didn't get that awesome Rhaenyra line where "I'll have my throne, or I'll have your head." I'm still hoping we're gonna get that line in some form.
There is one that just popped out at me though. When she says she doesn't want to be queen of the Ashen Bone, and it did remind me of that line that Daenerys had in Game of Thrones, where she said she didn't want to be queen of the ashes before, you know, she went and became the queen of the ashes. But this was when she was still in her right mind. But that did remind me of that especially. And there were a lot of lines. Or just like a lot of just scenes where there was that, you know, that ending shot of Rhaenyra just looking so fierce. And I saw it on Twitter where it was like that moment in The Bells when Dany just is like, "That's it, I'm burning everything." And you're like, same energy, you know? So I did see that. I was like, you know, it was interesting where, and I think it's been interesting over the course of the season where you feel those callbacks to Daenerys and sometimes a little bit of Jon, but mostly Daenerys, you know.
Yeah. So where do we think this is all now taking us in season two? Like, do we have any theories about what season two is going to entail? We know a little bit. I'll share a little bit of what Ryan Condal told me in our interviews, which are, you know, partly already published on EW.com. But Ryan told me, quote, "I'm really interested in picking up with all of those characters that we spent all of this time introducing, particularly Rhaenyra and Allison's families, and seeing what happens now that we flip the chessboard over and spilled the pieces on the ground. How do all those characters react? That's the story that we tell in season two and beyond." He also said that season two will, quote, fall into that ensemble piece where you're following multiple characters. They're not all in the same place, but this is still very much a story of Allison and Rhaenyra and their families pitted against each other. We're not going to suddenly pull away from telling their stories. It's just the nature of this thing. In season two, it really opens up the world in a big way, and the sprawl grows quite a bit. And then I remember something that Miguel Sapochnik, who was a co-showrunner, executive producer, and director on season one, he's no longer showrunning or directing after season one. He's just going to be involved behind the scenes as an executive producer. But he previously told me in a separate interview that there are three wild dragons that they designed already that we didn't see in the first season, but I suspect we'll meet them in season two. And then also we get the Vermithor reveal in this episode, which I think is really telling because it kind of brings in this idea of dragon seeds. Lauren, do you want to talk about dragon seeds a little bit?
Yeah, so I mentioned this earlier that on Dragonstone, there's a lot of dragons that are there that don't have riders. I assume that the three that he's talking about are Grey Ghost, Sheep Stealer, and Cannibal. I think we'll see, obviously, they need riders. And if you're a book reader, you know who the various characters are that come in. And some of these riders are people with supposed Targaryen blood. Some of them just seem to be people who have natural affinity for dragons. So, so that's interesting. So the dragon seeds coming in, and they're not exactly all noble characters. So kind of curious to see how they write the dragon seeds going forward. I'm also kind of interested how, you know, we had a lot of time jumps in this first season. I'm interested if they are going to do any more slight time jumps because some of Rhaenyra's youngest sons need to be a little bit, they were a little bit older than they are in the book. So I am curious if it's going to be that kind of soap opera thing where it's like, this person's a baby and on Monday they're 10 years old. Like that kind of thing where it's like, you know, all of a sudden this baby is like, you know, is a teenager. So I am kind of curious about whether that is going to happen or not, or how there's going to be some slight aging up of various characters. So that's kind of like one thing that I was thinking about, like how, about that moving forward. So.
Yeah, here's hoping the time jumps are scaled back.
Yeah, they're very sort of just like, you know, very, very sort of subtle. But, you know, because it is like right now, you know, as the dance commences, it really is just sort of action packed from here on out. So my thoughts and prayers to the CGI team of House of the Dragon, because I know they're going to have their work cut out for them. But I will say, hats off. I thought the dragon battle last night was spectacular. So,
yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Lauren. It's been an absolute joy to talk about this show with you. Any final thoughts before we kind of put a cap on the season finale?
It was interesting, like before House of the Dragon started, I was very curious if there was still going to be an appetite for the Thronesverse. Like, I know a lot of people didn't like the way Game of Thrones ended. So, I was just super curious, like, would people be into it? Would there be an audience? And it's been kind of gratifying to see, yeah, people are still interested in Westeros. People still like this world. People still like to talk about this world. So, hopefully this means we will, season two of West of Westeros will kick off, you know, shortly before season two of House of the Dragon. But we will have a wrap up. We have a couple of special episodes coming. We have a crossover episode with our pals at All Rings Considered talking about both House of the Dragon and the Rings of Power. And then we're going to have more of a season wrap up for House of the Dragon where we talk about the season as a whole. But that's coming up as well. So is there anything you would like to say, Nick, about our
yeah, experience? Listen, I feel like I'm going into hibernation at the end of this week. But, you know, as you mentioned, we do have some more bonus episodes. I also have a few more interviews that are coming up. One I will say is for anyone who loves the craftspeople, I spoke with Tim Lewis, who's the master armorer. And we talked about his experience designing all the swords and shields and, you know, the Viserys's Valyrian steel dagger. And also working with the Swedish swordsmith who made Blackfyre and Dark Sister. And also, you know, some key props of early episodes, which was really fascinating. And then from there, I'm going to keep some of the other interviews a little bit of a secret until we publish them.
I will look forward to reading them.
Well, thank you again, Lauren. This has been, again, such a joy. I will see you out in the great wide web. And that's it for this episode of West of Westeros. If you liked what you heard, follow, rate the podcast, and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. To keep the conversation going, follow Entertainment Weekly on all socials, at EW on Twitter, and at Entertainment Weekly everywhere else. You can also tag us at Nick A. Romano and at Morglar.
This episode of West of Westeros is hosted by Nick Romano and Lauren Morgan. Produced by Chanel Johnson, Sammy Junio, Nick Romano, and Lauren Morgan. Edited by Michael Classic. Full episode transcripts are available at EW.com.
New episodes of West of Westeros come every Sunday, right after the episodes of House of the Dragon air on HBO and stream on HBO Max. Stay tuned.